Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
I was burned out from exhaustion, buried in the hail, poisoned in the bushes and blown out on the trail. Hunted like a crocodile, ravaged in the corn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
Today on Route 51, we have a special guest, Adrian Knops, a 51-year-old Michigan man with ties to North Central Wisconsin. He graduated in 1980 from Kingsford High School. It's just across the Upper Peninsula border, south of Iron Mountain. Adrian survived a week in the Alaskan wilderness, stranded on an island in the cold and rain, battling gale-force winds, with no shelter, very little to eat, and inadequate clothing. Adrian is an electrician from Grand Ledge. That's near Lansing, Michigan. He was on his way back from a bear hunting trip with his friend and partner, Garrett Hagen, crossing the icy waters of the Misty Fjords National Monument in a 7-foot skiff overloaded with fresh game. Garrett Hagen left Adrian Knops on an island for what was supposed to be a short trip to unload the skiff onto a larger boat, and Garrett never returned. Adrian was found a week later by the Coast Guard, which spotted him by chance. He had survived on 4 granola bars, clinging to a tree in the wind and rain, leaving a farewell note carved in the butt of his rifle with only determination and, as you'll hear, a strong faith to help him stay alive. This is a story that's garnered national attention following Adrian's rescue last September, and it's a story that continues to inspire. If you'd like to speak to Adrian or join our conversation, he's taking calls at 1-800-780-9742. Or you can leave a message on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I'll read it on the air. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Adrian, thanks so much for not only being here, but driving all the way from Grand Ledge to make this appearance. We really appreciate it.
Not a problem.
Now, you're an electrician by trade.
I am an electrician, yes.
Well, tell us about your immediate family, your wife, your kids, your grandkids.
I have a wife, and she's actually a New York City girl, of all things. And we lived in New York City for a while until our first baby came, and we moved back to Michigan because we weren't going to raise our children there. So I have two boys. They're older now. They're 28 and 26. The 28-year-old has a 6-year-old granddaughter that is our very special girl.
How did your wife react when you made it back from this situation that you were involved in?
I wasn't able to make it back from the situation by the time I saw her. When she found out what happened, she was on the next flight out at 6 in the morning. So I was still laying in the hospital bed when she walked in. So she kind of looked at me and, excuse me, she kind of looked at me and like, what did you do now? type of a look. But she was quite relieved. She is a great wife, I will say that.
What's her name?
Her real name is Maria, but everybody in her family's name Maria, so we call her Esther. That's her middle name.
Okay. Tell us about your ties to North Central Wisconsin. You've got family here and also in the Eau Claire area?
Yeah, my sister and her husband, Mickey and Keith Lindbergh, they live in Wausau. And my little brother, Addison Knops, used to live here too, but he's in Milwaukee now. I have a bunch of family over around Menominee, Wisconsin. That's where my father grew up.
And that's the Menominee that's near Eau Claire.
Yeah, and there's a little town called Irvington, Wisconsin over there. And my dad grew up in a little country store over there, which has a lot of fond memories for me yet. And my mom was an Abbotsford girl. Actually, I think the farm address was in Dorchester. She grew up on a dairy farm not too far from here.
Well, let's say hey to all of your friends and family.
There's probably a lot of them out there.
You graduated from Kingsford High School. That's near Iron Mountain, just across the Upper Peninsula border.
Yep, Kingsford. We lived in a little town called Quinnesec. We used to fish in the Menominee River. We could throw a rock and hit Wisconsin.
Yeah, and so. That's the other Menominee.
That's the Menominee River. That's the border of the whole thing. So, yeah, always been around these parts of the woods.
Now, is that where you got your love for the outdoors growing up in the Upper Peninsula?
Yeah, actually it was. My grandfather, Andrew C. Knops, over in Irvington, he was quite the outdoorsman and hunter, trapper, fisherman, and I wish I had half the skills he had, but it kind of started with that, though my father never got into it. So at 16, I pretty much, my father never prevented me from doing it. So at 16, I bought my first bow and taught myself how to hunt, and then just slowly got into it from there.
And you must have been a fisherman growing up in, in the UP.
Yeah, Dad did buy us fishing poles probably when we were about 6 years old, and we fished down the Menominee River all summer.
Now, this story of survival that you went through, 7 days in the Alaskan wilderness without adequate food, clothing, or shelter, it's given you a lot of national attention, probably attention that sometimes you wish you didn't receive.
Yeah, that you don't want. I don't know. I don't even know half of what's going on out there. My sister kind of keeps track of it all, and she lets me know, but I haven't even read much of the stuff that's out there. I just have gone on with life, and I know people like to hear about it, and so I've agreed to a couple of these type things.
Well, we're happy you agreed to this one. And you're involved with some cable television documentaries that are coming up. Tell us about that.
About a month ago, they flew me back to Alaska, which actually I was a little apprehensive about doing, but it turned out real well. But there's a
who is they?
The Outdoor Channel has a production company that's doing a documentary. Well, they have a series coming up called Fight to Survive, and it should be airing in October. But they wanted to go and take me back and so they could see the area and maybe do some interviews and filming around that area and do some reenactments later this summer for their show. And so they flew me back up there, and we got a real good bush pilot and a bush plane because it's way back in mm-hmm. there. We got back in there and did what they needed to have done.
And that's going to air sometime in the fall.
Yeah, that one should be in October. And then Coast Guard Alaska was also there, too. I went back a second time with the Coast Guard.
And that's on the Weather Channel, correct?
That's the Weather Channel, right. And they have a new season coming up soon. I don't know when, but supposedly on the first episode.
That ordeal of yours, it left you with some medical problems. How's your health doing now?
My health is good. I didn't have any major medical problems, but my feet and my hands took the brunt of it because I lost so much weight and muscle that week. And right now it's just my feet. I got some nerve damage in my toes and the ball of my feet.
Is it going to come back?
I haven't found a doctor yet that told me yes or no. They just said wait and see. There's not much they can do about it. There's good circulation, little nerve damage. I just learned to live with the pain and get back to daily routine. It's not bad.
Did you have health insurance?
No.
So folks came together and helped you out with some of those expenses?
Yeah, a lot of the family did, and a lot of friends did too. And they probably covered about two-thirds of what it was. They put a pretty good dent in it, and we can handle the rest.
When you were out there on that island, you carved a farewell note on the butt of your rifle. You must have thought at that point in time that there was a good chance you were going to die.
At the time that happened, it was day five. And up until that time, I was very hopeful and very optimistic and positive. But you'd have to understand the logistics of what was going on. It rained all the time, 2 hours on Wednesday. This is a Sunday-to-Sunday event. And it didn't rain the first night or early morning, but then it started raining and never stopped except for about 2 hours on Wednesday. So the fifth day, you know, I was pretty cold and hypothermic, and I just endured the first day of a three-day storm. I didn't understand it was going to be a three-day storm at the time, but gale force winds, I first described them as like 50, 60 miles an hour. And my sister, Mickey, she found a website from the Coast Guard, and they had a ship in the area communicating with, and mm-hmm. they had recordings of 75-plus mile-an-hour sustained winds on Thursday. So I knew.
And you were out in the open clinging to a tree while that was happening.
Yeah, and to give the listeners an idea of the situation, Misty Fjords is a national monument. There's nothing around. The closest thing around it be 50 miles away, and it's just rugged, gorgeous, beautiful country, the most pristine area I've ever been in my life. And
give us an idea, our listeners, an idea of where this is. It's on the Chickaman River, am I pronouncing that right?
It's the Chickaman River. It's coming out. Actually, you know, a lot of information says that we ended up on an island. There was an island across from me a couple miles, but this is actually the mainland that Alaska shares with Canada. So it's part of the continent. And there's only like a 5 or 10 mile strip of Alaska that goes from like central Alaska down to the very tip of the southeastern part. This
right.
is southeast Alaska. And it's just a beautiful mountainous area with fjords cut back in for miles. These fjords go. And we were on a river, though, so we could hunt. And the river comes out and make a delta where it meets the ocean channel back mm-hmm. there, which is a big channel around the island across from us. And it's all salt water in there. Everything's salt water. And the delta of that river that I got stuck in was about a mile wide and 3 miles deep between the ocean channel and back up against the mountains where they went up. So that was the area I was in, and it was completely, pretty much completely flat, you know, a little bit of slope.
Yeah.
No standing trees. The tree I was in was actually an old tree fallen over, and the bush pilot's grandfather said that when he was flying back in there in the 40s, those trees were still there. So those trees are pretty old.
Well, this was a bear hunting trip. Have you ever hunted bear in that area, or in Alaska for that matter, before? Or was this like a first time for you?
Yes and no. Not in that area. In fact, that was a new area even to my friend Garrett, who lived up there. He lived about 100 miles from there. But we had hunted bear in other places and other islands and things, and we had gotten bear before. But this was a new area, and actually the main focus of this trip wasn't even a brown bear. It was a moose. He heard moose had been starting to repopulate that area, and he was really after a moose and happened to have a brown bear tag in his pocket. So when we were walking around, we were actually looking for moose sign. And we went up a salmon stream just to mm-hmm. see what was there. And we came around the corner, and there was this huge bear. he was standing up on his hind legs. He had gotten a fish, and he was about belly deep in water.
And this was a grizzly bear, but a black grizzly, according to what I've read. Kind of an unusual animal.
Yeah, he was, according to Garrett, you know, I've never researched it, but he said you could find bears like that in that area. And it was a black grizzly. And at first I told him not to shoot it, because we had shot black bears before together. And I have a couple at my house. And he said, no, it's a black grizzly. And he said, look at the body, look at the head. The head was massive, just massive. And it was a black bear, probably stood between 8 and 9 foot tall.
Big animal.
Big animal, huge head. And he had a brown head. So he was a two-tone type bear. Pretty special. So he took aim and he shot three times. And everybody says a 30-06 isn't good enough, but it worked real well with two 20-grain shells. But three perfect shots. And the bear went under, and then it came back up. You could tell it was ready to die. And I said, don't shoot it, because we had shot another
yeah.
big black bear in the water like that before. Same scenario. And we had to cut it up in the water, because you can't move it once it dies. So he shot anyway. So
you had this grizzly in the water, this massive bear, and then you had to clean it, right?
It's actually floating out there, so we had to wade out to get it. We were up to our waist anyway, a little over, in freezing cold water coming off the mountain. We drug it over to the bank, and as quick as it hit the gravel and a couple of feet of water, it stopped. We couldn't drag it, we couldn't roll it, so we started to cut it up right there, skin it out.
Now, I imagine you were working pretty fast.
Not fast. We were methodically, I guess, would be the story. If one of us was cutting, the other one was standing and watching, because there was other bears around.
And
you got the waters red, you know, blood everywhere. And you have
and a salmon stream.
And a salmon stream. And we saw other bears not too far away. So it's like, it's a very uneasy feeling being around that many bears, cutting up a bear in a salmon stream. So we went through. It took several hours to do.
Did you have waders on, long underwear?
No. Nope.
So you weren't dressed for the water?
No, actually, it was the tail end of a beautiful warm summer up there. And the day we went ashore, it was 60 degrees, sunny, calm. It was gorgeous. It was like a beautiful fall day here. And so I was just in blue jeans, some cheap rubber boots with white socks and T-shirt and a sweatshirt. That's all I had.
And now tell us about Garrett. He grew up in Craig, Alaska, so he knew the area. He wasn't a novice.
No, Garrett's family goes way back to his grandfather going to Alaska, and back in the early 50s,
mm-hmm.
and before Alaska was even a state. And there were loggers and fishermen. And when Garrett was born, his dad was fishing. So he was pretty much raised on a boat. The family said he took his first steps on a boat. And by the time he was 18, he had his own boat and his own commercial salmon fishing license. So he was on the water all the time.
He had a terrible boating accident, which took his life, yeah. But it's not like he didn't know what he was doing.
No, it had to have been. I mean, nobody was there, obviously, to see exactly what happened, but it had to have been some kind of freak accident where he lost his balance and fell out of that skiff alongside of his boat. And once you hit the water up there, if you can't get out in 10, 15 minutes, there's nothing you can do.
How close were the two of you?
I can honestly say Garrett was my best friend. Other than my wife, of course, that aside, family, he was my best friend. We called each other every week, talked anywhere from an hour or two. He would send me pictures, sometimes on a daily basis, of the fish he would catch and any weird fish you'd pull out of the ocean, I'd get a picture of it.
He's only 24 years old.
24, almost 25 by month. And anyway, he was very mature for his age. He was homeschooled, but he had a brilliant mind. He could tell you what rivers were in Russia and China and what fish were in them. And he knew geography and history like nobody I've ever seen. And he was very interesting to talk to. He spent most of his time alone, but when he was around people, he talked.
Now, on this last day, you had this big bear that you had to bring back, and you had, what, a 7-foot skiff?
They call it a Livingston skiff. It's a 7-foot skiff designed for being on a boat, just to go to shore and back, lifeboat type thing. So that's all he had. He had a bigger one at home, but he didn't have the right motor for it, so he ended up taking that one instead. And that was a horrible mistake.
And you had a bigger boat, but then you tried to take the bear on the skiff to the larger boat. Tell us what happened.
Yeah. Well, when we got the bear cut up, we had probably about 300 pounds of meat that we salvaged. We weren't even being real picky with it, but he always wanted to keep all the meat. In Alaska, you're supposed to, except for fall bears. They don't require it, but he does anyway. So between that and the hide, I had asked him if we'd bring the kayak with us in case we got something. He had an ocean kayak. So we packed all the meat in the kayak and then draped the hide over the top. It looked like a big grizzly floating down the river as
uh-huh.
we were going. It was
in the kayak.
It was actually kind of cool. And but once we left the little lagoon in front of that stream coming out of the mountains into the Chickaman River, we were later in the afternoon, and it was a warm day, and it must have been melting a lot of snow up in the mountains back in Canada about 10 miles back, and the river current had picked up considerably. It was 2 or 3 times faster than when we went in, and as quick as we got into that river and the current, the kayak flipped upside down because it was obviously extremely overloaded,
mm-hmm.
and it was all tied in. We didn't lose anything. So we went down a little ways, and we hit the bank, and straightened everything back up, got everything back in order, and the banks were like quicksand. The water moves so quick, and the sandiness
uh-huh.
of it, your feet just, there were several times we had to pull each other out, almost lost our boots. I mean, you went down quick in that sand. So we were careful with that, and we did that several times, and we finally got down to, it was almost low tide down in that river delta, and so the delta extended way out, almost to the Abundance, which is the name of his boat.
And you were trying to get the skiff and the kayak to the Abundance.
Yeah, that's his 50-foot fishing boat. And on the way down the river, we were talking. I said, Garrett, this isn't safe what we're doing. I mean, we had the water was only probably 2 inches from coming over the top of that little boat. Because up the river, we transferred the meat into the skiff
right.
because the kayak wasn't doing it. So the kayak ended up being just for the hide. And I said, hey, why don't I just stay on the bank, you know, and it'll make the boat safe. Go out, throw the chunks of meat on the boat, come back, get me. So he left you there.
He
does it 10 times a week. He does it 10 times a week for his whole life. And we never thought anything of it. Calm day, no waves, not even in the harbor. There was no waves. And the boat was only about a half mile out at that point. So we thought it was a good idea. And so he dropped me off. I took my rifle and his rifle just to take more weight out of the boat. And the boat did. It came up quite a ways. And he motored off, and everything was fine. I could still see him motoring out to that boat. And I watched him go all the way out. And it looked like he was right next to that boat. He was just a small dot at the time, but I stopped watching. I couldn't see any detail. So I was just looking at probably one of the prettiest surroundings I'd ever be in.
And he never came back?
He never came back. I waited in about a half hour. I waited and he wasn't coming back. So I scoped the boat out with one of the rifles, and I couldn't see the skiff or the kayak or him. Nobody was on board that I could see. No lights on. It was starting to get dusk, and nothing. So I waited another half hour. Still nothing, and then at that point I figured he had probably died, because what are you going to do in the middle of a harbor, disappear?
You ever figure out what happened to him?
Not for sure, but his brothers and friends and other people from his community, they took a big boat over and helped the Coast Guard search and do ground searches and all that. And they're the ones that actually found his skiff into the search. And they sat there where we anchored the Abundance, and they tried to figure it out. And the best they could come up with is, with the currents of the outgoing tide, which was almost at its bottom, and the river current that... between the currents and him maybe coming up to the Abundance and reaching for the rope to tie up to, he got a little wobbly in the boat, fell in the water, and he never had anything over the edge of his boat to climb back
up.
No
ladder or anything.
And we had talked about that. Water's
cold, right?
We talked about that for the last couple of years in our conversations. He just said, you just don't fall in. But he did. He fell in, and that's the best they can figure. And once you're in, it's...
And you were there by yourself. When was the last time you had food?
After we skinned the bear out and before we packed it into the boats, we sat down and kind of washed up a bit. And we had brought smoked salmon wraps.
So you had food that day.
I had food that day for lunch.
But you would end up being another 7 days.
Seven more days.
In the wilderness. What kind of provisions did you have with you?
It's kind of a funny story, but... the day we're about to leave, we're going to spend the night in Ketchikan Harbor, and he had no pillow for me. And I'm like, I'm not spending 10 days in this boat with no pillow. So next morning when we're going to leave, I said, you got to drop me off at the dock. I'm going to run to Walmart and get a pillow. And on the way by one of the shelves in Walmart, I saw these Quaker oat bars. And I said, that looks like a good idea. So I grabbed them. And I threw four of them in my little fanny pack that I always wear. when I went to shore. So I had four Quaker oat bars with me. And that night I was looking through my pack to see what I had. And I labeled them Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday in my mind. And I said, I'm going to eat one of these a day. It'll get me into it. Because I knew I was going to have to wait until at least Sunday before we're reported missing.
They weren't expecting you back right away.
No. And he was typically out of range for a week or two at a time anyway from his family. This is nothing out of the ordinary for them.
So you had four granola bars. You knew you were going to be out there for at least 4 days.
No, I knew I'd be out there at least 7 days, if not more.
How were you dressed?
Well, just my rubber boots. They're cheap. They're like $15 a pair up there. They call them cannery boots. And blue jeans and... my undershirt I left at the gut pile of the bear because it was all full of blood and I didn't want to deal with that. So I just left it there. So I had my sweatshirt, no hood on the sweatshirt, and then I had a little windbreaker with a hood.
A sweatshirt, a windbreaker, and that beautiful end of the summer was ending that day for you.
Ended that day.
Adrian Canopsi spent 7 days in the Alaskan wilderness without adequate food, shelter, or clothing, and he'll be back to tell us about that part of the story when we return. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Many rivers to cross, and it's only my will.
yeah, and I merely survive because of my pride.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics, Access Prosthetics, and Gimme Shelter play a huge role in the success of WPR. Your business can too. More information at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Wausau's Woodson Art Museum, presenting exhibitions featuring upcycled couture fashion and fiber arts on view through June 15th. Details about how to repurpose and reimagine everyday items at lywam.org.
If you just joined us, we're talking to Adrian Knops, who survived 7 days without adequate food, shelter, or clothing in gale force winds and extremely harrowing conditions in the Alaskan wilderness. He was rescued last September. Adrian is a Michigan man with a lot of ties to north central Wisconsin. And if you'd like to ask him a question, you can give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or leave a message on our Facebook page, and I'll read it on the air. As a matter of fact, Matt on Facebook wants to know if you still hunt bears, Adrian.
Only hunted bears with Garrett in Alaska. I did draw a tag in Michigan one time, but I was too busy and actually couldn't use it. But I have no problem hunting bears again if I need one. And mostly I'm an avid deer hunter, though. And this fall I did go deer hunting.
So despite this tragedy and this, you almost lost your life out there, you're still going out and hunting.
Sure. I mean, it wasn't hunting that caused that. It was an accident with my friend. Could happen anywhere, so... I love hunting. I'm more comfortable in the woods than anywhere, so that's where I go.
Now, you told us you managed to survive on just 4 granola bars, but you had 2 rifles and ammunition. Did you ever consider hunting for food, or wasn't that an option?
Actually, as odd as it seems, at first it wasn't even a priority. I wasn't hungry. In fact, I was never hungry when I was out there. I think I was just so cold and shivering and... But there was opportunities. Canadian geese landed all over. There was a seal that come to visit me. He was so cute, though. I would probably have to die first before I'd shoot him. But anyway, I think I saw him there when I went back again, too. It was raining the whole time. You know, I couldn't start a fire. The tides were covering the whole area twice a day. Everything was sopping wet, super windy, lots and lots of rain. So it's either I was going to eat raw Canadian goose or go hungry, and I opted to go hungry.
What were your biggest worries? Were you worried about wolves, other bears?
No. The strangest thing about the whole experience is there were a few things that were odd, and they came out odd to me while I was there. One is I never felt hungry, as I said before. I never felt afraid of anything out there. Never was in fear. I was cautious. I knew where the animals were. That's why I stayed where I did. but I was never afraid. And then I was never, you know, worried about the outcome of that whole scenario. I knew what I had to do to get out. I had to wait and do everything right in the meantime. The only thing I worried about, and it was a constant thing in my mind, there's a couple things. My family. I couldn't stand the thought of dying out there and not having them know what happened. That was like almost an obsession. 'Cause my wife, I would figure she'd freak out if she thought I was eaten by bears or wolves or whatever. And, that was a worry. And then the other worry is that I am a man of faith. I'm one of Jehovah's Witnesses, and I have a very close relationship with my God, Jehovah. And I didn't want to do anything wrong out there that he could, that he would view as unfaithful or disrespectful to life. And that was one of my goals, that I do everything right, and I maintain my ethics and my values, even though I'm in a bad situation.
Did your faith keep you alive?
Yeah, actually, from the first, after the first hour when Garrett didn't come back and I figured he was dead, with rare exceptions, kind of opened up a channel of communication, talked with him as a friend, and everything I did was with him.
So you never felt alone?
Never felt alone. Actually, that was the third thing that was odd. I never felt alone. The Coast Guard asked me on that first night in the vast Alaskan wilderness, you know, how did you react? And I'm like I was sitting around a campfire and at my house, you know.
Now, the weather changed quite a bit soon after you got stranded. Tell us how the weather changed and how you reacted to it.
Well, the first night was nice. It was like pristine, gorgeous, Milky Way, beautiful skies in Alaska. And I had a campfire because I always carry three ways of starting a fire. I didn't have a backpack, but I had a little fanny pack. And I got my steel wool and 9-volt battery out and started a fire and had a little campfire and kept warm. And I was soaking wet from coming up when the tide was coming in. I mean, up to my, pretty much to my chest, I was going through ice cold water to get to this little knoll where I had to be. So the first night was drying off and a lot of other things.
You were connected to the mainland, but the tide flooded everything around you, correct?
Yeah, well, you got to envision to the west of me was this ocean channel, about 2 or 3 miles wide. North and south of me were half a mile each way. It was mountains that were nearly vertical, 70-degree angle at least. And in the back of me, several miles, was the back of that valley with more mountains with a river coming through it. So that whole area, I didn't realize it the first night because it wasn't that bad, but every subsequent night after that, the whole area, the whole 1 by 3 mile area was completely submerged in tide.
So you were surrounded by water and you found a tree.
Yeah, it was on a little knoll, had the only standing marsh grass in the whole valley. So I went there that night at dusk. I could see it from afar off, and to get there, I had to cross through these little cuts in the river, and I was very cold and wet when I got there, but I broke off branches from these old trees and started a little fire. It took till probably about midnight to get dry, but I did get dry, and then that first night was just a night of reflection. Held a little memorial service for Garrett. I just couldn't let that go by. Without that.
When did the weather change?
Monday morning. I can't say I woke up early because I really didn't go to sleep, but at daybreak I went back to the back of the valley and tried to cross the river, but it was too fast, too cold, and too wide. So I just sat there, and then that morning, late morning, it started to rain. And for all practical purposes, it never stopped.
What happened to your fire?
The second night I started a fire in the rain underneath the curve of the big tree. The tree was like 4.5 foot diameter trunk that was laying on the ground, and started a fire there in the middle of the night. I figured, hey, no tide came up here last night. It came up to the tree, but not into my area. So in the middle of the night, I had this little fire, worthless little fire, smaller than a 5-gallon bucket for sure, like a 1-gallon bucket, but made me feel good. And, the water just kind of rushed in and took my pile of wood away, took the fire away. That was the last time I saw fire.
And there was a full moon, which you didn't know about because it was raining, and there were high tides, and you found yourself clinging to this tree for dear life.
Starting that night, Monday night, I had to jump into the top of that fallen tree, and then it had a 20-foot tall root base. It was a very large tree that stood up, and I had to climb about halfway up in there to get out of these tides that were being pushed in. And unbeknownst to me, other than the full moon, there was a huge storm out in the Pacific that was about ready to roll in.
And you encountered that. Tell us about the storm.
Well, throughout the week, Monday night, Tuesday, Wednesday, it just steady rained. Tuesday night was heavy, heavy rains. That was a hard night. It got cold, too. But Thursday, things started to change a little bit, and late in the morning, I saw a dark cloud. You know, more than the normal dark clouds. They weren't gray anymore. They were black. They were coming in over the mountains off to the west. And I'm like, wow, that's a pretty big storm. And all of a sudden it started to lightning and thunder. And I remember Garrett telling me, he said, they don't get storms like we get down here with lightning and thunder, and because they don't have the weather, the right warmth conditions up there. But storm was that way because it had been warm, and it was just lightning and thunder in the mountains. Just quite spectacular, actually. I was watching it come toward me. I'm like, this is a really cool storm. But, you know, I did realize I was standing in the path of it, and it was about ready to hit. But there's nothing I could do. I mean, where do you go? There's
no place. And then the winds came.
Yeah, about noon or so. I was just standing near the tree, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, just boom. I thought there were 50, 60-mile-an-hour winds, and my sister found a Coast Guard site that was recording them in that area at 75 miles an hour, just out of the blue, boom, coming down this valley. And I was like, whoa, and I got behind the tree, and that lasted all afternoon, those winds, and just the pouring rain.
And there you were without food, in summer clothing,
yep,
clinging to a tree that was surrounded by the high tide, and this went on for days.
3 days. Actually, the third day it got worse. By Saturday afternoon especially, the winds got noticeably stronger. I mean, if the first days were 75, these winds are 100 plus. And when I was behind the fallen tree, you know, you can get some shelter from the wind. But during the high tides, you know, you got to get out of there, because the tides came up around that tree later in the week about 4 to 5 feet. So I couldn't stay down on the ground.
How much sleep did you get during the 7 days you were out there?
Less than 3 hours.
3 hours total.
Yeah. I wouldn't sit down. I wouldn't lay down. I mean, everything was mud and wet, and I'm halfway hypothermic all week anyway, always with a shake. And I knew as quick as I hit that ground, it's going to be colder, mm-hmm, and I wouldn't last much longer. And if I fell asleep, my greatest fear was the tides. When they come in, if you're in the water and the water comes around you, even if I woke up and jumped up on the tree, I would be drenched with 40-degree water. And a couple of times of that, you know, you'd be dead. So I wouldn't let myself sleep, and the nights were pretty hard.
And you ended up finally on that seventh day. Was it the seventh day that you carved the message in the butt of your rifle?
No, it was the fifth day.
The fifth day.
After it was dusk, right after the first day of the storm. And after being blown around that day, I for the first time said, you know, maybe I can't get out of here. But then my greatest fear hit me. Nobody's going to know what happened. They're going to think that we were killed by animals, and these horrific stories are going to be going around. And they wouldn't know. It's just a crazy accident that spawned this waiting game for me. And
so what message did you put on the butt of that rifle?
I tried to make it as concise as I could be to give the story. So up on the stock, let's see, I carved Garrett Hagen, Craig, Alaska, which is his hometown, so that the gun could get back there. Died while taking his big bear to the boat. So I figured that told him he died alone in the water somehow. He had got the bear, mm-hmm, and where he's from. Then on the butt, I carved a canops, stuck on tidal flat, cold, wet, no food. I figure that gave a pretty good idea of what I was going through.
Adrian Canops survived 7 days in the Alaskan wilderness. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We'll be back with the story of his rescue after this.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be.
Let it be. Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Stevens Point Area Co-op, Peninsula Music Festival, and Import Auto Clinic. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from The Hostel Shop in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, committed to helping people rediscover the joy of cycling with recumbent trikes and a comfortable, efficient, and easy riding experience. More at hostelshop.com.
I'm Glenn Mobrick. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We're talking to Adrian Knops, a man who grew up in the Upper Peninsula and survived 7 days in the cold, the wind, the rain, stranded on a tree that he was clinging to in the Alaskan wilderness. Let's go to the phones right now. We have a phone call from Bill in Vesper. Bill, you're on Route 51 with Adrian Knops. Hello, Bill.
Sorry for the loss of your friend. I've got a comment and a question. First of all, I was a commercial fisherman in Alaska for 5 years back in the 70s. And, you know, your story is tragic. It's not uncommon. People in Alaska, especially in Southeast, I think have a very cavalier attitude towards safety when it comes to boating. I mean, you overloaded that soap dish boat with bear meat and tried to go, what, a quarter mile or a half mile out into the ocean to get to your big boat? I mean, people do that all the time, and I've lost friends that way. A friend of mine died when he was blackcod fishing, and the closure ended, and they just piled all their line up on the deck and started drinking beer for the four-hour ride back into Yakutat. Guess what? A wave hit them, swept the gear off the deck into the rudder and prop, and they went down. It happens all the time.
Bill, thanks for
the question. I have a question, too. You said, or you indicated that you were reluctant to talk about this event and, you know, that you didn't really like the publicity. Why did you agree to go on 2 reality shows about it?
Bill, thanks so much for the phone call. Adrian?
Actually, I wouldn't mind responding to that. I wasn't going to do that at first. And actually, it's one reality show. Coast Guard Alaska kind of did their own thing, and they started at the rescue, and they never even asked my permission to do anything. So what they do is kind of what they do. But the Outdoor Channel one, I wasn't going to do that, but I talked to Garrett, my friend's father, and he wanted to have a chance to say something about his son. So I said, okay, let's do that.
Was Garrett Hagen, was he a careless fisherman, a careless boater?
No, he wasn't careless. But I will say this, the caller that was there, he made some valid points. And I joined a fishing forum up there in his hometown and discussed that. And it has brought a little bit of awareness to them because that is kind of an issue up there. And he's not wrong in saying that.
Bill, thanks so much for the phone call. Adrian, you were finally rescued by the Coast Guard. It took 7 days. When did they find out that you were missing?
They found out about 3:30 in the morning on Sunday, a week after it happened. That final day of the storm with the 100-plus-mile-an-hour winds, it ripped a big boat off anchor that I had been staring at all week because that's why I wanted to stay in the area. I figured if the Coast Guard saw that boat, they're going to know we're there, and I'll be, hey, right here. So when that boat went adrift that night, it was a little mini cruise ship back in that canal. Actually saw it drifting with anchor down, and so they boarded it and sent a couple mechanics on board. And make a long story short, their mechanics thought they had to rewire their own batteries into the boat, which they did, and they lit the boat on fire, and it burnt and sunk. So everything we had was gone.
That boat drifted away during the storm that let people know that there was something wrong so they could start the search.
Yeah. The interesting thing is there was 2 things that week that were horrible enemies, and that was the wind and the rain, and both of them saved my life because the rain made the water just pour off the mountains so I could walk a third of a mile to the mountains and get water, all I could drink. And then the wind, if that boat wouldn't have been ripped off anchor, Nobody would have found it that night. Coast Guard wouldn't have been called, hopefully, until the next day by the family. Then they would have started Monday, waiting a day to see if we weren't just late. So,
and that might have been too late for you.
Might have been too late, because that final morning, Sunday morning, after that, the third day of the storm, things let up, but it was still raining. And that morning at the break of dawn, well, right after a big bear came by, I watched him for a little while. And then I just couldn't stand up anymore. I was exhausted. And the pain was excruciating in my joints. So I, for the first time all week, I laid down in the marsh grass.
Do you think there was a higher power involved here? The fact that the wind, your enemy, and the rain, your enemy, ended up saving your life?
I don't know how it happened or why or what part God's hand had in it. I think that there's probably something of that there. I don't personally feel that God runs around saving people or guardian angels. Otherwise, why did Garrett die? Why didn't he save him? So that's not God's job, but you can't tie God's hands either. And I had a whole week of prayer with him, and I maintained my faith and my goal that I didn't compromise my values in any way. So.
And your faith helped you save your life.
Oh, sure. It kept me calm and level-headed. I never did anything without discussing it with him first. I didn't do anything stupid. I didn't try to swim that river, which would have killed me, I'm sure. So there's a lot of factors there.
When you first heard the Coast Guard helicopters, tell us about that.
Well, after I laid down in the grass early morning, I didn't remember anything after that. I think I passed out because those choppers are very loud. And as quick as they entered that valley, I should have heard it. But actually, it came in. I was almost a mile and a half back in that river mouth, and I didn't hear it till it was right 150 yards from me. And it woke me up, and I stood up, and they had their tail pointed to me, working their way on the other side of the river real slow, looking the other way. And no windows in the back of the helicopter, so it just kept going. I'm waving my little orange life jacket and waving, and they just kept going. They went all the way to the back. It took a while. I could see them back there. And then they disappeared back up the river into the mountains. And
But they got you on the way back.
On the way back, they got me. And it was by a fluke because the pilot told me they had stopped looking. And they were speeding up. They were going really fast. And they were headed out of there. And just as they passed me, the pilot said he lowered the nose to go faster with their little jets or whatever they got. And the rescue swimmer happened to look to his left. They weren't even looking anymore. They caught a glimpse of the orange life jacket.
If it had been another second later?
Fraction of a second. They said that I was so lucky they couldn't even believe it.
Was there ever a moment during this ordeal, Adrian, when you questioned your faith?
No. That was the only thing I had out there, that and the draw of my family. And that was my anchor. And so I just – actually, I increased my relationship with my God. And I never doubted it at all. I always wanted to make sure that I'd get out of there intact no matter what happened, even if I lived or died, didn't matter, that I was intact with my faith to God.
What is the message, if there is one, or the lesson that you hope other people get from your story? You've spent an hour talking about it here this morning.
Well, there's a bunch of them. Everything stemming from what the caller is. Think a little bit more before things happen. Try to be as safe as you can. You know, we thought we were, and I was relying a lot on Garrett, but, you know, everybody involved in a hunting party has to be responsible for themselves. That's a minor point. Other than that, don't ever give up hope. You don't know what happens. Because when I was out there, you know, the rifles were there. I thought one time about ending it. It was a fleeting glance. I don't believe in suicide. But it was a pressure that was there. You have to push that out of your mind. You don't know what's going to happen in the next minute. So you don't ever do anything unfaithful. And third, always stick to your values and your ethics that you have. You really have nothing else. And really the big things that people, or the little things that people sweat in life today, you get back into this world away from the wilderness and people are road rage, everything else, and all that stuff doesn't matter. Just take it easy.
Adrian Canops, thanks so much for being with us today. We want to thank today's guest, Adrian Knops. You can look for more of his story this fall on Coast Guard Alaska on the Weather Channel and also on the series Fight to Survive on the Outdoors Channel. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Bob Dylan, Jimmy Cliff, John Denver, The Beatles, The Rolling Stones, and Al Green. Next week on Route 51, we welcome our special guest, author, comedian, musician, Michael Perry of Tent Show Radio. Thanks again for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.